Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. A Cult of Personality podcast is available on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, Acast, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode 171, featuring an interview with Danny Newman, who specializes in entheogenic symbolism in Masonic ritual. The Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section, and our patrons who participate via the Occult of Personality Patreon campaign. I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs for me to bring it to you are significant. Your financial contributions make sure this free podcast continues. Please support A Cult of Personality by joining the membership section or donating via the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. Our Patreon page now features an exclusive RSS feed for patrons, meaning that if you subscribe via Patreon to support the show, you will get some extra content just for you. And if you're already supporting the show, or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structure training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Now, in episode number 171, an interview with Danny Newman about his research into the intersection of psychedelics and initiation. P.D. Newman is a Scottish Rite Freemason and a Masonic Rosicrucian. The focus of his research is on the presence of entheogenic symbolism within Masonic ritual. He has had papers published by a variety of Masonic periodicals and popular websites. His book, Alchemically Stoned, The Sprig of Acacia and the Psychedelic Secret of Freemasonry, is planned for release in 2017. Alchemically Stoned, The Sprig of Acacia and the Psychedelic Secret of Freemasonry is a groundbreaking work which explores the ceremonial use of the powerful entheogen dimethyltryptamine, DMT, within Masonic ritual. The sprig of acacia is an important symbol within Freemasonry, but unbeknownst even to the fraternity's own initiates, the acacia is rich in more than just symbolism. Newman details the actual use of acacia-produced DMT by alchemically inclined Freemasons as early as 1762. His premise challenges everything we think we know about the history, nature, and aims of the Masonic fraternity. And if you support Newman's work, be sure to hit the GoFundMe page for his book, listed in the show notes. Now, I confess that I was a bit under the weather during the recording, and despite my efforts to be open-minded and let guests express themselves unencumbered, I did not quite manage that in this instance. However, Newman acquitted himself rather well, and he makes a strong case for entheogenic symbolism. But you'll have to make up your own mind as to the accuracy of his claims. And if you do accept the historical validity, then what, if any, is the modern implication? Danny Newman, I want to welcome you to a Cult of Personality podcast. It's a pleasure to speak with you tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited about the interview.
Yeah, same here. Why don't we begin by having you give us a little bit of your background in esotericism and how you became interested in all this stuff?
I was raised Southern Baptist in Mississippi, so I wasn't really exposed to anything esoteric as a kid. But there's a big mushroom kind of psychedelic scene going on in the Deep South because they grow wild everywhere. And somewhere around the age 11 or 12, we started experimenting with mushrooms, learned how to pick mushrooms. And it was those experiences that really led originally my brother and I into a lot of different esoteric territories like yoga and ceremonial magic and odd things like that came about just through mainly through curiosities that were piqued from those psychedelic experiences. And I guess I had a particularly profound experience on mushrooms that led me to the decision that I would kind of set aside psychedelic exploration for a while and pursue more traditional avenues of initiation, and that led me to Freemasonry in 2010, I guess, is when I became a Master Mason. And shortly thereafter, I was invited to join SRICF, which is a Masonic Rosicrucianism. And not long after, I became a Scottish Rite Mason and a Knight Templar, and I was just gung-ho for a long time. And it wasn't until, you know, I'd been a Mason for, I guess, a year or longer that I really started to give a double take to, you know, the acacia symbolism and some of the other symbolism that popped up that really, those investigations were what led me to where I am now, you know, with these, what I think are pretty significant discoveries regarding, especially acacia and DMT and its use in Freemasonry.
Right, right. Well, why don't we lay it out for us, if you don't mind? Give us your argument, your thesis, and I think it's a pretty interesting one. We'll let the listeners be the judge of it.
Particularly the DMT argument.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, DMT, the Acacia, the Freemasonry, I think, you know, it's pretty, it's, if nothing else, it's kind of compelling and I think makes people think, or I would hope so anyway.
Sure, yeah, no problem. Well, of course, you know, Freemasons aren't using DMT and Lodge now or in a Masonic context, but, and certainly, I don't believe that they were earlier in a, you know, under the UGLE or any of these other major organizations. But I do believe that by the time that we had people like, first off, we see it with Melusino, comes along in, I think, 1762. He was a Russian, I don't think he was a general. He was something in the Russian army, and he was a Freemason and wrote the Melusino Rite. And in this rite, he specifically talks about producing a stone from acacia, which he calls treasures, somewhere in the text also. And talks about, he identifies the stone as being the same stone that was placed to Isaiah's lips whenever he saw these visions of heaven, I suppose. The DMT present in acacia, I just can't perceive of any other reason why he would be doing this, why he would be saying, identifying the acacia itself as the primal matter of alchemy, and then further identifying the stone itself as being this compound that he produces from it that he identifies as being the same as the stone placed to Isaiah's lips. And what really becomes interesting is, in the book of Isaiah, in this verse he mentions, the angel says, thine iniquity has been purged. And if you look up acacia and Mackey's Encyclopedia and a couple of other texts, they translate acacia as being Greek for innocence, which is purged of iniquity, absence of iniquity. So that's a pretty interesting coincidence there. And not long after this, we see Cagliostro show up. And Cagliostro and Melusino were known to be friends. They supported each other's work. And we know Cagliostro met Melusino when he went to Russia. And you know, his trip to Russia is documented in the whole, what's that, Diamond Necklace movie or whatnot with Christopher Walken. But in Cagliostro's rite and his, what he calls his Egyptian rite, even though it's not Egyptian per se, he has his initiates drink a concoction of acacia, and he tells them again, this is the primal matter. And I suspect he got this from Melusino, if not from the rite of strict observance, which is what the form of masonry they both became master masons in together. I don't think in the same country, but they were both initiates of the rite of strict observance. So Cagliostro has his initiates drink this concoction of acacia and tells them that it's to raise their spirits in order to understand this lecture he's about to give them. I guess because of the profundity he encoded or, you know, put in within this. And for anyone who doesn't know, the big thing about DMT is it's not alien to mystical practices. There's several indigenous communities that use this stuff from in the form of what's called ayahuasca. It's DMT mixed with another compound that makes it orally active. It lasts up to 6 hours in that way, but if you smoke it, it only lasts about 20 to 25 minutes. And you also have it in the form of snuffs, such as like Yopo, which is Y-O-P-O, if anyone wants to Google that, or Epena, which I think is E-P-E-N-A. And these are DMT snuffs that are made from, you know, calcinated shells and bones that make it absorb into the mucous membranes in the nasal cavity and make it active that way. But this stuff isn't unknown. And it really, really starts to get interesting when Rick Strassman, you know, he put out his book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And, that's really what got everybody interested in DMT in the first place, because, the movie came out afterwards, the documentary, But what nobody mentioned in the documentary was, if you read in the introduction, it might be in the preface, it's in the very front of the book, you know, Strassman says that this research was funded from a grant from the Scottish Rite. And I've never been able to get anyone in the Scottish Rite to tell me, you know, what the interest in this was, and especially, you know, how it relates to the symbolism of the acacia and the Master Mason degree. But it certainly starts to look like we have more than just a few coincidences lining up here. And like I said, I don't think the early Masons were necessarily using the acacia in this context, because if we look at the earliest degrees, it doesn't say acacia, it says cassia. And granted, cassia is a phonetic anagram of acacia, so it could just be a blind. But we don't see acacia show up until around the 1730s. So makes you wonder if acacia was changed to acacia because of its relevance, the DMT content, or if we just had people like Cagliostro and Melusino come along later and say, hey, you know, we could, transvaluate this and bend it to our own ends because we're aware of this compound that's present in it. And I'm sure they might have believed that was the function of the symbol in the first place, but that's, you know, we can only speculate. But that's really the heart of the DMT argument in Freemasonry.
Wow, you've really given us a lot to think about there in just a very short period of a few minutes. If you don't mind, maybe we could just back up a little bit, because I'm not sure people listening are even following everything that you just said. So one of the things I wonder is if you could just briefly, if you're able to, talk about the symbol of the symbol of acacia in Freemasonry now, and then maybe from there just talk about other instances that it's mentioned in the Bible. I know, you know, there's, aside from the Isaiah, you know, there's the Ark of the Covenant, and there's probably a lot of others.
Sure, yeah, it's mentioned as being the wood used in the Ark of the Covenant. It's mentioned as being used in the building of Noah's Ark. It's referenced in some versions of the Rose Croix degree that the cross was made out of acacia.
Now, I've been told, and I don't know this myself, but I've been told that acacia wood was so valued in desert climates because it, the grain was so tight that it was impervious to rot or infestation of any sort. So that's why, you know, you would have carried the Ark of the Covenant if there was such a physical thing in that sort
wood. Yeah. It also is a food source. That's where we get Arabic gum, acacia gum. That's a staple in lots of Middle Eastern dishes, and it's also used in a lot of incenses and things. I did have a recipe used in one Masonic order that called for acacia itself, but it wouldn't be in any amount that would have caused a reaction. I mean, just acacia powder itself, it would have taken massive amounts of it.
Huh.
But its significance in Freemasonry, it comes into play with the central myth or allegory of Freemasonry, which is the story of Hiram Abiff. Hiram was the architect, the grand architect of the Temple of Solomon, and one of the grand masters, the original three grand masters of Freemasonry. And it was his custom to go up at noon and draw up his temples, his plans for the temple, on his tracing board. And on his way to do this, he encounters three ruffians, which, without going into that, there's obviously deep symbolism in the three ruffians and their names. And, but what they do essentially is they say, give us the master's word. And he tells them, I can't give this to you because this isn't the proper way to receive it. If you're worthy of it, you will eventually receive it yourself. and they demand it and essentially kill him for it, and he dies. They hide his body, and before the body is discovered, they want to come back and bury it properly, but it's just in the hurry, in the scurry of the moment, buried under this rubble, under the rubbish heap, and they place a sprig of acacia there over the grave so that they can find it later. And this is essentially how the fellow crafts who come searching for the body find him. They pull out this sprig of acacia. And the traditional interpretation of the sprig of acacia is that it represents the immortality of the soul, because acacia is an evergreen, and some degree, some versions of the degree, it just says evergreen. It doesn't say acacia. So it's widely accepted that that's the meaning. But what I find fascinating is that the meaning of that evergreen is the same as what happens if you employ acacia in a psychedelic context. When you use DMT, what you get is proof of the soul. What, I don't know what else you'd call it when you have an outer body experience. When you realize that you're having continuity of consciousness beyond the mortal frame, I don't know what else we would call that proof of. It could be a fallacious experience of not really what's happening, but the experience is that you are separate and what we might call an astral form. So that's the real significance in Freemasonry. It's just as an evergreen that was marked the grave of where Hiram was buried.
So basically, to accept your argument, people would have to identify this symbol, which represents the immortality of the soul, with a plant substance that can be ingested, sort of, whether it's alchemically or psychedelically or what initiatically, I don't know how you want to describe it, but essentially to what have you, illuminate your consciousness, essentially producing the immortality of the soul or the experience of that, I would imagine, if done in the proper context. So I don't think that's completely far-fetched argument.
No, I don't think so either.
I can see how some people would be reluctant or resistant to it just on the face of it. You know what I mean?
Certainly, yeah. I have a number of detractors that argue against this, and I welcome it, because this is what I really want is a dialogue opened about this kind of stuff. We see so many things come into the fore in Freemasonry. People are willing to kind of get back to the esoteric side of what some of this stuff means, but no one seems to want to discuss anything about psychedelics and their relevance as far as a spiritual pursuit or a tool. That's really my goal, is to get Freemasons thinking about psychedelics and to get people into psychedelics thinking about Freemasonry, because I feel like there's a lot of crossover there. And it's not, I'm not saying I want to, you know, overload lodges with hippies. What I'm saying is, you know,
you're giving me a vision here that, it on one hand, it's pretty cool, but on the other hand, like, I can see a lot of, I don't know what I would say. I guess my initial reaction to what you're talking about is, man, that just doesn't seem like something that Blue Lodge Masonry is prepared for. You know, like you said, like Masonic Rosicrucians or like some Scottish Rite body, you know, but I don't know. I can't see it in like mainstream Blue Lodge.
It shouldn't be a part of the degree work. It shouldn't be anywhere in the lectures. You know, it shouldn't be. Masonry is complete in and of itself. This is something we talk about extra, that might be suggested. And even if it's not suggested, we know that certain Masons were interpreting it this way, like Cagliostro and Melusino, and bending it to these ends, to this specific end. So,
But what I find intriguing, though, is considering your argument, like, when you think of Cagliostro and some of these more esoteric degrees, the inference, I think, is that, or implication, is that these degrees are, like, more esoteric, more, in some ways, more authentically interpreting the symbolism or the meanings. And if we think about the biblical symbolism, well, maybe they're right. Maybe you're right.
They could be. I feel like I am right as far as, you know, Cagliostro and Melusino goes. But I'm not willing to take that leap and say that's what the acacia was put in masonry for.
Okay.
I do have a suspicion that, and, you know, we talked about earlier the rite of strict observance that both Cagliostro and Melusino were initiated into, which was a form of the first three degrees. And in their master mason degree, they have a very curiously worded phrase, a portion of the lecture that comes up when they find the acacia. And the acacia, the ones that do have DMT in them, the DMT is primarily in the root bark of the plant. It's not mainly in the bark on the branchy portion of the tree. It's not really in the leaves. It's in the root bark. And in their version of the Master Mason degree, they find this acacia and pull it out, and they say, this has no roots. It must signify something. And before it says that, it says the masons who sought the stone wanted to climb. Now, I'm not sure what stone they're talking about, because it kind of reads like they've mixed it with the Mark Master degree, with the stone that the builders rejected.
Right.
But it says that the builders who sought the stone wanted to climb, ascend, is kind of what I think about.
Yeah, I mean, I'd automatically assume, you know, Jacob's ladder there.
Mm-hmm. They sought the stone, wanted to climb, and then they realized that the acacia had no roots. And I quote, it says, this must signify something. So what does that signify, the fact that it has no roots? And that's why I think maybe that's the place to look, right, of strict observance, because that's where both Melusino and Cagliostro came from. And both of them were practicing alchemists and... I've seen several claims that the rite of strict observance were practicing alchemists, had active alchemy lodges. I know Hogan makes that claim somewhere.
Now, do you have any evidence pointing to either other esoteric orders aside from irregular masonry or... maybe, you know, like ancient mysteries would be a good example of other groups that were employing these methods as part of their tradition?
Not specifically acacia. The only places that really shows up in an initiatory context is in the Caribbean, in the Amazon Basin. And, mm-hmm. and it's used when a male is going through his puberty rite. It's used to kill the child to resurrect the man, which is, you know, eerily similar to what we see in Freemasonry. I know it's not a child that's going down, but it's the same kind of idea, resurrecting to something larger. Which for them, being a man isn't as simple as it is. It for most cultures and these indigenous cultures, being a man implies all these other things, all these other virtues, like spirituality and a lot of the virtues espoused in Freemasonry.
Right.
So you see them use it, and they also use it for the shamans when the shamans are acquiring what they call, some cultures call their manas, their higher wisdom. When the shaman is going through the ritual ceremony, again, they'll use even larger amounts of these DMT snuffs or ayahuasca to kill that man and then resurrect him to something more than a man. But I'm reluctant to call these ancient mysteries. Other ancient mysteries we do see, you know, entheogens showing up, which I believe again has echoes in Freemasonry. For example, with the Eleusinian mysteries, it's believed that the Kekion beverage that caused thousands of people at a time to experience this vision of the gods or of their own immortality, because as it says that they would see themselves in the heavens with the gods and the people below them who weren't initiates in the muck beneath their feet. And in 1971, Carl Ruck, who is the professor of classics at Boston University, he wrote The Road to Eleusis, along with R. Gordon Wasson, who discovered psilocybin mushrooms, and Albert Hoffman, who synthesized psilocybin and discovered the psychedelic effects of LSD. Well, they published this book, The Road to Eleusis, where they explained that the most probable way to induce this kind of experience for massive amounts of people at a time was to give them a psychedelic beverage. And but the problem has been, what was that beverage? And they were the first ones to propose that it was ergot, because the Eleusinian temple was adjacent to what was called the Rarian Plain. This is a huge rye field, and rye produces Claviceps purpurea, which is one of the sources of ergot. And so they proposed, based on the ingredients for Kikion, which is provided in, I think in Homer's, one of Homer's pieces, it's described as being barley groats, pennyroyal mint leaves, and I think just water is the third ingredient. I have to double check, but you know, none of those are obviously psychoactive. But when you consider that the ergot, that the rye could have been infested with ergot, then it becomes a whole other story. So we suspect that the Eleusinian mysteries were using it, and the Mithraic mysteries, it's suspected they were using mushrooms, among other psychedelics, which they called magical dinners, a series of magical dinners that constituted a large portion of their great work. So yeah, we have that. We have a number of, the most obvious would be Soma with the ancient Vedas, and on to certain sects of Hinduism and into Vajrayana Buddhism, where it becomes Dutsi or Amrita. You know, we still see this use of a psychoactive compound that elevates the user and is used in an initiatory or divinatory context.
Yeah, I'd like to table that one, if you don't mind, for a few minutes.
Sure.
And come back to it a little bit later. And if I forget, please remind me.
Yeah, they both relate to other sample chapters from my book that I sent you that we could probably touch on, with the Amanita muscaria mushrooms and the ergot.
Yeah. You've been a Mason for a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, that's true.
And you've joined a number of appendant bodies in Masonry. And you've published papers, you've been given papers on this very subject that we've talked about, as well as others. And I'm curious, it seems like, you've, like you said, you kind of like jumped in with both feet and really got involved in terms of the research and understanding the symbolism. But what I'm really fascinated by is it seems like it took you in such a radically different direction than it does most everyone else who goes into this research, at least in Freemasonry.
Yeah, I agree. I have yet to meet, I've met a few, but not many people that are looking in the same directions as am I. But I just think it's, like I said, when I came to Freemasonry, I wasn't really looking for any of this stuff. I had no idea. I was looking for a traditional avenue of initiation that was relevant within my own culture.
But to be clear, you were you were already interested in these subjects before Masonry.
Which subjects? Psychedelics?
Psychedelics and initiation. And
before I became a Mason, I had been studying Kabbalah and yoga and things of that nature for almost a decade. I had been kind of working with Aleister Crowley's AA system for a while. I kind of cut my teeth on Crowley and Rigardi and all those Golden Dawn guys.
So I've
already read that stuff.
Yeah, that's some extremely, I would say, in my opinion, extremely powerful practices, and certainly can put an edge on things, I think.
My brother and I went that direction because Crowley was the only guy who was talking about the caliber of experiences we were having and admitting that part of that it was due in part to these drugs, to, in his case, mescaline and hashish, you know. And it was for the first time, it was validating for us, because we were off in the deep end, you know. We didn't have anybody to talk to, and when we'd try and talk to someone that we thought kind of had a grasp of this stuff, our language was obviously not the same, and we just kept running into these barriers. But Crowley seemed to really give us hope that we weren't the only ones, you know, dabbling in this kind of stuff. And then later we found, you know, Terrence McKenna. You know, when you first find Terrence McKenna, you feel like you struck gold. But a lot of his ideas really resonated with us when he talked about the logos and things like that, that we had, were really, you know, pertinent to our experience at the time. Hmm. But yeah, we had both, my brother and I. My brother's not a Freemason, but he's my partner in crime. We're only 14 months apart, so he's always been there, and we've always been each other's guinea pigs for a lot of these things.
Now, I have to ask you, because it sounds like from our conversation so far and previously that these experiences have been expansive and led you in a multitude of directions. But in my experience, there's also the possibility, it's like, you know, two sides of a coin. You know, the other side is the person and uses the psychedelic and then kind of gets trapped and is like, oh, this experience itself is it. And then that they're done, right? And that's the danger, I guess, of it. So it's like I see it as like a double-sided coin. Other people see it as like, you know, I've talked to them on this show, you know, David Chaim Smith, Craig Williams, I think I would be accurate in saying, like, they view these things as dangerous either from a health perspective or from a perspective that it can, like, limit one's either understanding of consciousness or what they're of what the path actually entails, or that it can be damaging to the nervous system. I mean, I think there's all kinds of caveats to these things, which may be true. I'm not saying they're not, but what is your reaction to all these things I'm throwing at you?
It's the same reactions, you know, that most psychedelic explorers encounter, because people who are dedicated to a path get frustrated when someone tells them that they've had this profound experience by taking a drug. I can completely see where they're coming from, but it's frustrating. But to say that it causes any kind of damage, I mean, the research is being done now. We're learning that these compounds actually regenerate brain cells and make you use more of your brain than before. And I would never say that they're dangerous. They've been used by not necessarily things like LSD, but things like, you know, peyote, mushrooms, and ayahuasca. These things have been used for untold millennia by humans. And as Wasson suggests, may be the source of religion itself, may be the source of the what he called entheogenesis of religion. And I would by that much sooner. And I also think that there's this drive to, in the West especially, to experience, not in Western religion, but in Western mysticism, there's this drive to experience this stuff independent of any external sources, out save meditation or something like that. And I reject that. You know, I don't think we do anything in a vacuum. I think we do everything in cooperation with nature. And I think I told you before, but I feel like any spiritual practice is man-made, is created by man. And they might say, well, it was divinely inspired, but the bottom line is man created it. But we know that man did not create nature.
Yeah, but you know, but I would also argue that, like, you've got like a conceptual division between man and nature, and I would argue that there is none. And to say that man created it means that it is divinely inspired or created, because it is created by nature. Because man, despite our attempts to break free and subjugate and separate, I don't think you can separate ourselves from nature in that way.
I agree completely. And that brings up the point, you know, everything is natural, even plastics. You know, these are all an expression of a natural world. And that's not really what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is more nature itself, not something that, and I know the alchemist, the big alchemical axiom is that the alchemist assists nature. And I totally get that. But when you say that things are dangerous, I don't think they're dangerous to people. They may be dangerous in the context of a certain system. I'll grant that, because what they do is they loosen the bonds of belief structures. So if you're being indoctrinated in a particular system, then yes, they're terribly dangerous, because they do not allow indoctrination except in one's own gnosis and the vision one has. Like you said, you do run the risk of having this grandiose vision and saying, aha, I've got it, you know, but that can happen with any spiritual discipline, whether it be Kabbalah or yoga or
no, that's or true. That's
anything.
That's a valid point. Yeah.
And Crowley, just to mention him again, he warned against that. He said, you know, don't mistake the plateau for the final resting place. You know, every glorious revelation we have is, there will be an equal and opposite truth revealed at some other point. I mean, that's been kind of true from my own experience. You know, everything that we feel like, oh my goodness, this is it. Let's it right then, you know, but there's another it moment, because we're more complicated than that. There's not one answer. Truth is, I don't think is, it's not concrete. It's something that's fluid and changes with every breath. You know, it's not absolute, I don't think.
So,
no, I don't think they're dangerous. I think I think it's dangerous to suggest they're dangerous, especially after all the research that's going on, about their place in medicine, psychiatry, spirituality. We're at a whole new, I don't even know what to call it. We've never been able to discuss psychedelic compounds this freely. It's in the dialogue of, in a positive context, not a negative one. That's what's so staggering about it. It's never been this in the media since the 60s, and then there was nothing positive. So I really feel like we're at a fortunate time to discuss this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would agree with that. This kind of leads into my next question about the overall reaction to your material, both within Masonry and in, you know, more generally.
It's been primarily positive, but all the positive reactions have been from people who have experimented with these compounds and know the profundity and the girth of the experience they can offer. I have encountered a lot of flack, I've gotten hate mail for some of my stuff, but I expect that, you know. Most of the negative reactions come from, you know, people who not just in masonry, but even from Golden Dawn circles, you know, different things that I mentioned about Reverend Ayton and his use of Selma with the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, just different things like that, different attacks I've experienced, because people don't want to think that, like I said before, they don't want to think that a drug was involved at all. You know, it used to be sex that was terrifying. You know, people are using sex to attain enlightenment, but now the most terrifying thing is drugs. I do get a lot of negative reactions. I'm about to start speaking publicly on the drug topic. I've speaking publicly on in lodges on things like, you know, Kabbalah and just different Masonic symbols, but never on the psychedelics. So it's gonna be interesting. We'll see what kind of reactions I get in a live context.
That's interesting. I'm curious if you've ever compared some of the physiological reactions from like Kabbalistic meditations with the head movements and things like that, or like breathing exercises or different postures. I mean, I'm assuming in doing like AA work, you've gone down all this stuff before, and I'm just curious, how you'd compare that to the psychedelic experience.
There's definitely some crossover. I had the most profound experiences I had outside of psychedelics was with pranayama, different pranayama techniques, and later in the practices we were incorporating cannabis smoke in the pranayama. Some of those experiences were approaching on the psychedelic, but I've never had an experience for meditation. And I might be, you know, what Dal Malachi with this Sophian Gnostic tradition, he calls it a hard case. They use psychedelics, or he suggests, I guess, that psychedelics can be used for hard cases who can't attain these visions and experiences on their own. And, you know, I may be one of those hard cases, because I've never really gotten any just what I would call a profound result from any spiritual practice or prayer or meditation aside from pranayama, which I did have some really incredible results with pranayama. But the crossover is, it's not to say that they're not similar, because they're, like, for example, when meditating, you might have an experience of complete dissolution of self and you know, merging with the all, and have this experience of oceanic bliss. You know, I've heard people talk about that. I have had that experience on LSD, and I've had a suspicion when meditating that, oh, that we're all one, that this is illusion of separateness. But the difference is the profundity of the experience, because it's like with the psychedelic experience, it's what McKenna called terrifyingly real. And even if it's not terrifying, it's the word is used for the intensity of it. There's no questioning it. There's no escape from it. When you're going through it, you are going through it. And there's no saying, oh, this isn't real, I'm on a drug. Because it doesn't matter if you're on a drug. When you're realizing something of that profundity, the drug is insignificant at that point, just like the meditation is insignificant. And I know people do purport those kinds of experiences, and I feel like they're possible, but, you know, I have to admit, I've never had any success with them.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Danny Newman and I continue the interview discussing the evidence supporting his conclusions about entheogenic symbolism within Masonic ritual. And specifically, we talk more about his upcoming book, Alchemically Stoned, The Sprig of Acacia, and the psychedelic secret of Freemasonry. Don't miss that excellent conversation. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. It's the best way to support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.